This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Wednesday, after spending months locked down during the pandemic, cafes take another hit, shutting the doors due to a lack of staff. And the EU accuses Belarus of using asylum seekers as weapons of war as troops gather on the border with Poland. The coalition once derided it as Bob Brown's bank, and under Tony Abbott tried to abolish it entirely. But today, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation is at the centre of Scott Morrison's latest policy to help achieve net zero emissions by 2050. The Prime Minister has announced $500 million to set up a green fund to turbocharge low emission technology, including the controversial process known as carbon capture and storage. It set the stage for a major election fight. David Lipson reports.
It is great to be back here in Melbourne.
The Prime Minister back from Glasgow, yet only now rolling out the policies he says will help Australia reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Yesterday, electric vehicles. Today, funding for green technology.
Currently small, complex, technology-focused startups can be considered too risky to finance. So we'll step in.
$500 million is on the table to establish an investment fund to support low emissions technologies, with hopes the private sector will match it dollar for dollar. It'll be administered through the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, which the coalition used to disparage as Bob Brown's bank. The Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, is among those who, in 2013, voted to abolish it. Now,
we're interested in any technology that can commercially bring down emissions. We don't want to pick and choose a technology on some kind of ideological basis. Anything that can work.
As examples, the government's citing carbon storage in soil, livestock feed that reduces methane, and glass coatings for solar panels. And the most controversial of all, carbon capture and storage, where CO2 is sucked out of the air, contained, then transported to a suitable site where it's pumped underground, hopefully forever.
The track record, I'm afraid, globally is overwhelmingly one of failure.
That's Ahmed Abdallah, a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. He says there have been some successful carbon capture and storage projects, but
just because a project succeeds when it comes to carbon capture, it doesn't mean the capture will be permanent. For example, one of the successful projects in the U.S., ceased operation once oil prices fell and it became unprofitable to capture the carbon for oil recovery.
One of the biggest barriers is cost.
I'm very confident that we continue to reduce the cost through developing new technologies.
That's Ralph Hayes, the director of the Peter Cook Centre for Carbon Capture and Storage Research at the University of Melbourne. He's bullish about the future of CCS technology, but points out not all projects are equal.
The cost for carbon capture and storage actually varies quite significantly. When we take an oil refinery, we have almost a pure carbon dioxide stream. We don't have to do a lot more chemical engineering to separate the carbon dioxide and put it in the ground. Whereas if we use a different carbon source, then it may become a lot more expensive.
One of the most difficult sources of carbon to capture is coal.
It's not going to play a role in coal. There is no evidence it will ever play a role in coal.
Chris Bowen is the Shadow Minister for Climate Change and Energy. He's long been opposed to taxpayer dollars earmarked for renewables going to carbon capture and storage, but is leaving the option of supporting this plan on the table.
Our objection has been the constant attempts by the government to dilute ARENA and CEFC funding away from renewable energy into carbon capture and storage. If this is genuinely new money, then we'll look at the detail.
Opposition leader Anthony Albanese believes it's a policy aimed at politics.
It's all about wedging Labor, not about the substance.
Labor's yet to put forward a substantive climate policy as internal debate rages over whether to push for much greater commitments or avoid the threat of another scare campaign by falling into line with the government and fighting the election on other issues.
That's David Lipson reporting there. Well, as the Glasgow Climate Conference enters its final days, frantic efforts are still underway to get the world's biggest polluters to slash their emissions. Experts warn that negotiations at the summit are not on track to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. That's the marker that's seen as vital to avoid catastrophic consequences. Overnight, a global coalition of researchers declared that even if countries do fulfil the pledges they've put on the table, the world will be on track for an increase of 2.4 degrees by the end of the century. David Sparks has more.
Outside the climate conference in Glasgow, Indigenous groups from around the world say leaders are failing. Among them is Andrea Ixiu from Guatemala.
We think that what has been happening inside of the COP26 is a negotiation of bad behaviour between people that is contaminating, polluting our planet, and the people that is holding power position.
Even inside the conference, the sense of urgency is growing. Britain's Alok Sharma is president of the COP26 summit.
We are making progress at COP26, but we still have a mountain to climb over the next few days. And what has been collectively committed to goes some way, but certainly not all the way, to keeping 1.5 within reach. The gap in ambition has narrowed. Now the world needs confidence that we will shift immediately into implementation, that the pledges made here will be delivered, and that the policies and investment will swiftly follow.
An even starker assessment has come from a global research coalition called Climate Action Tracker. It's released a report showing the short-term emissions reduction goals nations have committed to by 2030 would likely lead to warming by 2.4 degrees by the end of the century. And more optimistic predictions are based on longer-term 2050 pledges. One of the analysts, Claire Stockwell, is in Glasgow.
There's a great diversity within these updates that countries have submitted. Some have clearly strengthened their targets, like South Africa and Morocco. Others are a little bit harder to assess, like India, which announced its update last week at the World Leaders Summit. And still others have submitted updates with nothing new in them.
So, with 3 days left, what can the Glasgow Climate Conference achieve? Macquarie University's Professor Leslie Hughes sits on the Climate Council. She's also a former lead author of reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Well, they're progressing, but there's still a long way to go to close the emissions gap between what the world is emitting now and what it must reduce to have a hope of staying close to the Paris targets.
A group called the Climate Action Tracker has come out with an analysis saying that what countries have currently got on the table in terms of their commitments leading up to 2030, I think they're talking about in terms of commitments for reductions, would lead to a global temperature increase of 2.4 degrees by the end of this century. Do you think that they're possibly on the money?
Look, they probably are. The previous analysis of a gap under the Paris pledges was that we would get to 2.7 to 3 degrees if all of those pledges were implemented 100% and on time. So 2.4 is better, of course, than 2.7 or 3. There have been another couple of analyses done over the past week, updated with pledges currently on the table in Glasgow, the one by Professor Malte Meinshausen at the University of Melbourne gives a figure of 1.9 degrees, which is the same as the International Energy Agency. So the updated pledges give us a lower temperature, which is a good thing, but where, you know, 2.4 or even 1.9 still means an awful lot of increase in the frequency and severity of extreme events and therefore impacts.
That's Professor Leslie Hughes from Macquarie University, ending that report from David Sparks. The United States has started vaccinating primary school children against COVID-19, but Australia's immunisation advisers will be watching it closely before giving the shot here. Our vaccine advisory group says despite successful clinical trials of Pfizer in 5 to 11-year-olds, it needs more data to ensure safety and efficacy. But now that COVID is disproportionately infecting children, particularly in schools, and parents anxiously await a decision about when their kids will get the jab. Catherine Gregory reports.
Melbourne mother Krista Lyon is pretty desperate to get her two primary school children vaccinated against COVID-19. She's even considering a trip back home to the US to ensure it happens soon. That's because in the States, children aged 5 to 11 are getting the Pfizer jab right now, while Australia is still yet to approve it for that age group.
And if it's a matter of waiting, you know, 6 months or a year for something to catch up to Australia, then I'd rather see them safe and being able to be actively participating in the world around them than continue to have to keep them isolated.
Miss Lyon says her two kids are particularly vulnerable to COVID, so she's been keeping them home from school during the latest wave.
And what the doctors consider to be concerning if they were to catch it. The unknowns are not something I want to play games with. So if it means that we have to take them somewhere else to get it, it's definitely something that for us is a card that's on the table.
Children or the 0 to 19 age group now make up a large proportion of COVID cases in both New South Wales and Victoria. Dozens have been admitted to the ICU, and hundreds of schools have closed across the two states because of COVID transmission. Natalie Beek is another concerned parent based in outer Sydney and a founder of COVID Safe Schools.
We're currently opening a federal petition to the House of Representatives to ask for a federally funded COVID Safe Schools program, which would require CO2 monitoring in every space, in every classroom in Australia, and HEPA filtration where needed.
Miss Beek says ventilation in classrooms is not good enough and many primary school students don't wear masks. So vaccinating this age group soon should be a priority.
Approval could be fast-tracked. We have the data. The decision by the FDA was a unanimous decision that the risks of contracting COVID for a child aged 5 to 11 far outweighs the risk, very small risk, of vaccination.
America's top medical regulators, the FDA and the CDC, approved the vaccine for children based on Pfizer's trial of about 3,000 participants. But Australia's immunisation body, ATAGI, is waiting on real-world results out of the US first before it gives a green light. Associate Professor Margie Danchin is a paediatrician and an immunisation expert from the Murdoch Children's Institute.
The initial data does show that it works well in terms of a good immune response and that it's safe in terms of those common and expected side effects. But the trial was not big enough to detect any of the serious and rarer side effects, such as the myocarditis and pericarditis that has been identified in the older teenage group.
Those rare side effects she's referring to is inflammation of the heart or lining around the heart, which has been found in a small number of older teenagers, but it's not caused any deaths. So why is the US going ahead? Well, Professor Danchin says compared to Australia, it's got much higher rates of infection, including in children, and an overall lower or less even vaccination rate in adults. And COVID is still mostly mild in children, she says.
At the moment, we haven't seen an increase in severity, even with the Delta variant.
Are you concerned that signalling to the public that there is a pause, that you're waiting to see how it goes from the US, it might be fueling some vaccine hesitancy amongst parents?
What we need to tell everyone is that we're not expecting vaccine safety signals, but we just want to be sure and we want to collect more data.
Professor Danchin expects that ATAGI will make a decision in the next 4 to 6 weeks. And if all goes well, hopefully children could start getting vaccinated before the new school year.
That's Catherine Gregory. On ABC Radio, right across the country, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Overseas now, the European Union says Belarus is using gangster-style tactics in an escalating standoff over migrants. Poland has sent thousands of troops to secure its border, accusing its neighbour of using the migrants as weapons of war and encouraging them to cross. The EU is now planning further sanctions against Alexander Lukashenko's regime, which is already isolated over human rights abuses. Europe correspondent Nick Dole reports.
In a freezing cold forest in Belarus, thousands of migrants have set up camp. They huddle around fires to keep warm, contemplating whether they should try to cross into Poland.
Attention.
Polish forces on the other side of the razor wire blast a recorded announcement through loudspeakers, warning them not to try.
You will face criminal charges.
Some migrants are undeterred. Using axes, they cut down trees and try to build a kind of bridge over the razor wire. Polish forces respond with what looks like tear gas. Poland sent more than 12,000 troops to guard the border. Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki has addressed them, blaming the President of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, for orchestrating the crisis. Lukashenko's regime uses civilians as weapons of a hybrid war, he says. We know that this is a fully planned operation which aims to disrupt the sovereignty of our country. That's absolutely clear to us. We know for sure that there is a search for weak spots. This is the latest flare-up in what's been an ongoing challenge for Belarus's neighbours, including Lithuania and Latvia. The European Union says its sanctions against the Lukashenko regime for election fraud and human rights abuses are starting to bite.
Lukashenko regime starts to behave as a gangster regime because it's hurting them and they don't know what else to do, so they try to undermine the European Union.
That's EU foreign spokesman Peter Stano. He says the migrants, many of whom have travelled from the Middle East, are being actively recruited by Belarus.
They reach out to potential clients, to these potential travellers, through seemingly official channels. Belarusian consulates, Belarusian embassies, travel agencies and other intermediaries which are issuing, for example, visas and telling them, OK, you can come and then transport will be organized for you to go to the border. So I think we have quite a good idea about the pattern which is being used by the Lukashenko regime.
Alexander Lukashenko denies the allegations and is accusing Poland and the EU of turning their backs on refugees. He's got on TV to say Belarus is trying to de-escalate the situation, but he says his allies in Moscow are watching. If, God forbid, we make a mistake, if we take a wrong step, then it will instantly drag Russia into this maelstrom, and it's the largest nuclear-armed power. I'm not a madman, he said. It's a comment that was offered as a reassurance, but might be taken by Belarus's neighbours as a threat.
That's Nick Dole reporting there. Well, so soon after Melbourne's famous cafes and restaurants opened after lockdown number 6, many are now having to shut again or limit their trading hours, not because of COVID outbreaks, but because of a critical shortage of hospitality staff. Restaurant owners say skilled international workers have long gone as a result of the pandemic and they can't get local staff to fill the shifts. Emily Burke reports.
The excitement of lockdown ending and the resumption of dining in has been tempered with a harsh reality that there are not enough staff to cook the food and serve. The Victorian government announced a $44 million package to entice people back into Melbourne's eateries, and from next week, diners will be able to claim 30% back on their bill if they spend between $50 and $500 at cafes, restaurants and bars. But some of the more established venues are closing their doors midweek.
You know, we want to open, everyone wants us open, the government's want us open, and we're unable to open to the full extent.
Sean Kearse owns the two Ladro outlets in Inner Melbourne and spoke to ABC Melbourne.
Pre-pandemic, positions were often easier to fill. What I think has happened is that a lot of the visa holders who are the backbone of our industry have either gone home or they've moved interstate or they've found other industries to work in.
Jason M. Jones owns the Entrecote restaurant.
We've had to make the call only yesterday after only opening last week after being open and closed for 20 months or so, but we can't even open for breakfast any longer because simply we just can't get staff to fill the shifts.
It is such a crisis. It's worse than it's ever been. It is all anybody is talking about. It's absolutely dire.
Danny Vallant is a food journalist.
People were already understaffed 2 years ago, but the various impacts of the pandemic have made it absolutely distressing for many restaurateurs. Probably the biggest factor is all the internationals that have left Australia because they weren't offered JobKeeper, they weren't looked after during the first year of the pandemic. There's also hasn't been that influx of visitors, international students and backpackers that Australia gets every year, plus, of course, the skilled workers that are brought out on sponsored visas, they haven't been coming in either. So there's that. There's also the fact that a lot of people during lockdown have realised that perhaps hospitality isn't an industry that was working for them.
As far as the industry goes, is there an issue around wages for those skilled staff? I mean, there have been very high profile claims of wage theft, and barely a day goes by without the Fair Work Ombudsman announcing an audit or a breach or legal action. action and fines against hospitality operators. So is that playing a part in this?
I think definitely hospitality's got a reputation problem among Australians as an industry where underpayment and bad conditions are rife, and that certainly has been and continues to be an issue. I would say that the high-profile airing of those compliance issues has helped the situation somewhat. At the moment, I think what you are seeing is it's an employee's market, so there is no reason for anybody to take any position that isn't offering them award, wages and conditions.
How do we unlock this?
Well, I mean, I think unlocking is not a bad word to use, because we need to unlock the borders and bring in fully vaccinated workers who are ready and willing to fill these positions. And it is about a more long-term series of measures to be taken around making hospitality seem like a more attractive and viable career for Australians who are, you know, leaving school or on the verge of leaving school, and looking at it more longer term in terms of training and looking at a whole culture around respecting hospitality as a place to work.
That's food journalist Danny Vallant, Emily Burke, with that report. 18 months after Rio Tinto blew up the 46,000-year-old Juukan Gorge in remote Western Australia, pressure is mounting on resource companies to better protect land that holds significant cultural value for Indigenous people. The state government is working on amendments to its heritage laws, but some shareholders want to see a more immediate response. One of the country's top miners, Fortescue Metals Group, chaired by billionaire Andrew Forrest, is the latest company to confront the issue at a shareholders' meeting in Perth. Matt Bamford reports.
Our team is committed to safeguarding our environment.
It's been another big year for Fortescue Metals Group. Surging iron ore prices have helped deliver a record $14 billion profit. But some investors are worried. 18 months after Rio Tinto destroyed Juukan Gorge, they're concerned it could happen again. Rio's actions sparked international outrage, a reputational spiral, and the resignation of several senior executives.
Whilst that Juukan Gorge disaster completely shocked the world, what Rio did at that time was legal. But it looked to everyone involved outside of the company like it shouldn't have been. And that's the gap between community expectations and the legislative environment, which clearly had not kept pace.
Mary Delahunty is from superannuation fund HESTA. The $52 billion fund is part of a push to ensure FMG avoids a similar fate. It's joined several large investors in supporting a resolution calling for an overhaul of WA's cultural heritage bill.
We know that companies, through their lobbying efforts, can have a genuine and significant impact on legislative outcomes, and we would like them to use that significant impact to make some really good contemporary changes.
But at last night's annual general meeting, the resolution failed to get up, with a majority of voters blocking the move. Chief Executive Elizabeth Gaines outlined the company's stance.
Fortescue supports the modernisation of the WA Aboriginal Heritage Act, including legislating an increased voice for Aboriginal people and equitable rights of appeal for all parties. We also support the West Australian Government retaining responsibility for Aboriginal cultural heritage within our state.
Finance Professor Raymond De Silva Rosa from the University of Western Australia says the social justice concerns of shareholders are becoming harder to ignore.
We're operating now in an environment that's very different from it was, say, 10 or 15 years back, when sites would get destroyed with much more impunity than they are now, so people are much more aware.
What's being different is the ability now with social media for smaller groups of people to have their voices amplified.
HESTA has already put 14 Australian resource companies on notice around Indigenous heritage protection. Mary Delahunty says the fund will continue to pursue action through consultation with Aboriginal groups.
For as long as they believe that this legislation is not contemporary and does not represent best practice, then that will continue to be a topic of conversation between us and the companies that we invest in.
Mrs. Eaton is from the Yamatji Malpa Aboriginal Corporation, which represents native title holders from the Juukan Gorge area.
We are not saying no to mining. We know the mining have to go, but at least the mining company and the government itself come back to the table and talk with the TOs.
After fighting to be heard for so long, she's pleased that more people are speaking up.
I hope the shareholders are helping us out on this, because otherwise we're going to keep on going like you're going to damage that place and we in the newspaper again. We don't want to do that.
That report from Matt Bamford. That's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. The PM team will be along tonight. to bring you the latest news that's unfolding across the country and around the world. Thanks for your company. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Stay safe.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Just before midnight US time on Friday, Joe Biden had a big win. He passed a massive bipartisan trillion-dollar infrastructure package, something he promised during his campaign for the White House last year.
It's a significant step, but it's still only a partial victory. There's a second bill in the pipeline worth even more, and just getting it through a Congress controlled by his own party is proving incredibly difficult.
Today on The Signal, what is Joe Biden's big plan and what does it mean for America?
Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.